I mean, I'm good at writing tunes. So being the kind of obtuse fellow that I am, I try very hard to go away from that. Otherwise, I'd just be churning them out. It would be so simple for me to churn out album after album of good tunes, where you walk out of the building singing the set. I don't have a problem with that. I guess if I wanted to lose the audience entirely, which it seems I'm doing the best that I can at the moment, but I... But... Exactly. I couldn't have put it better myself.
My name is Mr. Touchwick. Touchwick, mail over and fantasy. My shop sells eggshells off the seesaws and empty females. I'm thinking of leasing the room above my shop to a Mr. Wolof Bomberg, a reject from the worldwide internet. He's a broken man.
Hello and welcome back to Album. I'm Arslan Mohammed from a windy rooftop in Malta. In this episode, we welcome back with waving arms the one and only Nick Pegg, the author of The Complete David Bowie, to take us outside, where I am right now, outside. Yes, we're finally getting to the 1995 epic One Outside, which was meant to be the first instalment in a series of millennial angst works. Naturally, Bowie being Bowie, he tired of this idea almost immediately and went off and did Earthling about 2 years later instead. But let's stop to think about Outside and what a major piece of work it was at the time. You couldn't really blame the Britpop-snorting music press for not getting it. I didn't get it at the time either. I was busy being an insufferably elitist indie kid. But revisiting Outside for the purposes of this podcast, I'm really struck by how absolutely committed Bowie was to the project. He really could have rested on laurels following the mild commercial and critical acclaim he received for Black Tie White Noise in 92, indulged his love of the esoteric in low-key projects like The Buddha of Suburbia in 93, and attempted to clamber aboard the Britpop bandwagon in the mid-90s with some sort of chirpy Cockney cabaret. God, Britpop. Anyway, he didn't, luckily, and it's all the better that so, because Outside really is an amazing album. Well, I know you know that, and you know that I know that you know that, so why don't we cut to the chase and bring you the first in a two-part podcast in which Nick Pegg brings us deep inside Outside.
Too distant and
emotionally, or
Nick, come back to me, please. We
purely
have to talk.
Acoustically.
Yes, we have to talk.
Yes. Oh, all right. All right. We got to talk.
We've got to talk. We are going to talk, and it's a wonderful welcome back to Nicholas Pegg, who's here with me for this episode of Album to Album. And Nick, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Arslan. It's an absolute delight to be back again.
It is a delight to have you back again. And here we are, back where it all started in London. And it's a lovely day, and this
beautiful,
evening,
isn't it?
It's a beautiful day, exactly. Perfectly suited to this bucolic, wonderful, pastoral, folky album that we're going to be talking about.
yeah, absolutely. It's a great match, isn't it?
It's a great match. This album is an album I've really been enjoying rediscovering since Nick and I decided to talk about it. It's an album that I hadn't really got to grips with in the past. It kind of passed me by when it came out, because my mind was elsewhere. But I think it's a very important part of the canon. It's certainly one which is due for an appraisal, and it was very misunderstood on its release. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you One Outside. Or to give it its full title, and brace yourselves, The Diary of Nathan Adler or the Art Ritual Murder of Baby Grace Blue, a non-linear gothic drama hypercycle. And coming up next on Radio 1. But, Nick, you chose to do this album.
Yes.
Why did you choose this particular one to talk about now?
Well, I agree with everything you've just said, that this is an album that was overlooked or misunderstood or just plain laughed at by a lot of people at the time. And one day, eventually, when everyone else catches up, and they are beginning to, I think, people will realise, he says pompously, that this album is as great a piece of work as anything that David Bowie ever did. I think it's probably, for me, his best album of the 1990s, and there are plenty of other contenders for that title as far as I'm concerned. It comes at a very interesting period in his career because, of course, you know, we know the whole story about how the 1980s went a little bit stop and start for him, and then Tin Machine happened, and then he had this sort of gradual creative and critical, eventually critical, sort of renaissance and rehabilitation, if you like. A lot of people didn't quite catch up and say, yes, we're back with Bowie now, until a bit later, until maybe sort of Heathen time or something like that. Right. But right through the 1990s, he was producing such fascinating work, often quite confrontational work, quite consciously going, look, I'm not going to play Let's Dance and Rebel Rebel, so if you're going to turn up to my concerts, don't expect that. Yeah. You know, that was his sort of attitude. And I think it was as much to do with, he was challenging us, but he was also challenging himself, and that's key. You know, he didn't want to become that middle-aged rock star sitting back on his greatest hits, going out every couple of years to do the circuit and sing Rebel Rebel again. You know, he wanted to do some new and interesting stuff. And it is actually interesting that this album falls in... The first half of the 1990s was actually a spectacularly odd period for him, because he was veering between this sort of obscurity and the mainstream, and back and forth, swinging like a pendulum. If you look at, you know, if you start maybe with Tin Machine in 1989, his famous sort of retreat from the mainstream, and then immediately after that, the year after the first Tin Machine album, he took his greatest hits out on tour and did the Sound and Vision tour. He sort of put Tin Machine on ice for a bit and went out and did the biggest sort of most commercial greatest hits tour you could imagine. Then he went back and did another Tin Machine album and went and toured with them. Then he went solo again, disbanded Tin Machine, and did Black Tie White Noise, which is an unusual album, but was a very commercial album, and indeed was a number one album. It was his most successful album for many, many years, in the UK
it
anyway.
It could be said to have been Let's Dance 2.
Yeah, well, Nile Rodgers had that.
A very slick production.
Right.
You know, very commercially orientated. Yeah.
Exactly. And it had that very sort of saleable sheen. Yeah. And it came out in the spring of 93. And in fact, what felt at the time to me as a Bowie fan quite a symbolic thing, that it was just the time when a lot of new British groups were coming through who were acknowledging their debt to Bowie, and among whom were Suede, who I think is a fantastic group. Then, of course, not long after Black Tie White Noise, which was an album that took him a very long time to record, it took almost a year of on and off of sessions, he then recorded another album incredibly quickly, the Buddha of Suburbia album, with Brian Eno, who Bowie hadn't worked with for many, many years, not since Lodger. Obviously, they were still friends. Eno had been to Bowie's wedding in 1992, around about the time that Bowie was starting to work on Black Tie White Noise. And when he heard The Buddha of Suburbia, he got very excited, and they kind of, you know, started talking about working together again. And out of that came the album, which eventually, after a very long gestation period, became The Outside album. So there's this odd, as I say, this odd kind of roller coaster of commercial, obscure that was going on in the early 90s. But this certainly, Outside was, this was his great big sort of, okay, you know, let's see how much you can take, sort of album, wasn't it? Because there is nothing, you know, accessibility is not its key note. I think that's
no, it's, to say. It's not an album that people run to for accessibility, is it? I mean, it's not something that would have been a regular fixture on The Breakfast Show on Radio 1 in the morning.
Certainly not.
But it's very interesting what you say about the roller coaster of styles and approaches that Bowie was taking post 1990. So obviously, you'd had Tin Machine, which was his first departure from 80s pop, which had reached the nadir of Never Let Me Down. Well, not nadir, as we once discussed, but
backed out of the
cul-de-sac of Never Let Me Down.
Right, right.
But do you think at this point, here he was, 10 years down the line, happily married, very secure, and getting to know the YBA movement, you know, becoming friends with Damien Hirst and so on, starting to really plunge back into art in a big way. Because art, of course, was, you know, the YBA was movement was taking off immensely, and Bowie was at the heart of that. He was writing for modern painters, he was getting excited about the embryonic internet and tech at that point. It was a very fertile period, and he and Eno went to the Googing Institute in Austria.
That's right. Went and, you know, visited this place and saw a lot of, you know, what we sort of perhaps rather glibly refer to as outsider art. But it's very interesting what you say. You know, everything that you said, again, I agree with. But, you know, this album Outside landed in the, and was born out of this very, very productive and creatively fecund period for Bowie, that he was fascinated in. He'd always been interested in art, of course. He'd always been interested in painting, and he'd done a lot of it. But this was one of his periods where it really became integral to what he was doing. And he did a lot of painting himself during this period. He was writing for Modern Painters magazine, as you say. He was hanging out with a lot of artists. He was getting to know people like Damien Hirst. It was that very time when all of those artists, people like Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, Rachel Whiteread, were becoming. They were sort of getting headlines in the tabloid press, right, which was unheard of.
Art was the new rock and roll. That hadn't happened before.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there are so many ways in which the Outside album sort of lands in the middle of that, and also not just in the world of art, also in the world of, I think, of popular culture generally. It feels so in tune with so much else that was going on in 95 when the album finally came out. You know, it's got that kind of. It's set in a sort of trashy cyberpunk sci-fi world that you were seeing in films like, you know, 12 Monkeys or maybe even Pulp Fiction, which, although that wasn't a science fiction film, but that came out in 94, didn't it? And The X-Files and that whole kind of David Lynch feel to it. It was very, very, it's a very sort of early 90s, mid-90s sensibility. And of course, that wonderful film Seven that came out practically, I think, the same week as this album, and indeed used The Heart's Filthy Lesson as its closing credits. I mean, Seven is almost like One Outside the movie, isn't it? I mean, they're both about a murderer whose murders are their great sort of masterpiece.
Yeah.
That's in their own different ways. That's
death
the sort
art.
Of subject, death as art.
Death as art
and death as art. So there's all that, but you know. But that doesn't mean that Bowie was just sort of sucking on a bit of this and a bit of that. Mm. I mean, only David Bowie could actually come up with the idea of doing a concept album about art and minotaurs and architecture. Again, you know, Bowie always had this kind of science fiction shtick going on, didn't he? And at this point, he started recording early 94 and carried on recording for up until the beginning of 95. He was getting very interested in the impending millennium, which is, you know, we're now looking back on it from years later, aren't we? But then
it was quite quaint, wasn't it?
But this
millennium.
Yeah.
but that's true, because he was in a very unique position. It was still far away enough,
yes,
you know, 5 or 6 years into the future, to be comfortably abstract and be able to be assessed through a variety of artistic perspectives. Yet it was close enough to be genuinely quite, you know,
it's coming.
Imminent, it's coming.
And I think he was also just intellectually fascinated by the idea that the millennium, although it's a thing, it was this thing coming at us, and people were building the Millennium Dome and planning their concerts and whatever they were going to do. It's also meaningless. It was nothing. You know, the only reason that we had the millennium was that we happened to count in base 10, you know, that we have 10 fingers on each hand. That's the only reason that we count years like that. And it's an utterly arbitrary, imaginary moment in time, which Mother Nature and the universe doesn't care about at all. It doesn't actually exist. We invented it, and then we invested it with this extraordinary sense of sort of historical weight and importance. And I think that fascinated Bowie, because he was always fascinated by that sort of thing, this sort of the way that we create these strange compartments and prisons in our mind almost. And, you know, so that all gets filtered into this album as well, I think. And you mentioned the internet a moment ago. That's another thing that we have to think back to, remember where we were in 94 and 95. Bowie, as ever, was a sort of early adopter, but most people didn't have email. I didn't buy an internet until, I think, 1998, 99, something like that. Yeah, I certainly didn't have email until then. Yeah, I know.
I had email in 96.
Oh, there you go. But so, even so, even there, 96.
Do you remember when you got your first email address?
But the point is that Bowie was there before most people. He absolutely was. And also, more importantly, he could see what was coming far more clearly than a lot of people did. I distinctly remember the time of Hours in 99, someone interviewed him and said, oh, the internet is just sort of CB radio, isn't it, for, you know, it'll for, and Bowie said, no, seriously, trust me, it isn't. And that was at the end of the, you know,
that was a very famous outside interview with Jeremy Paxman.
That's right, yes.
Which has been
amazing.
Doing the rounds a lot recently on the internet.
Because it is so prescient, isn't
it? It's so prescient, and he has a pretty good stab at guessing how the music industry is going to work out. He can see how the internet's going to take over everything.
Yes.
And it is astonishing. But back in 94, like you're saying, when he's doing this.
Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary piece of foresight. But and it's not just about the technology of the internet. Yes, it is going to catch on. It was about how that whole way that information is managed and how it becomes accessible to us and how we all become publishers and authors and we all have a voice. You know, the whole social media revolution, which is, you know, something that's happened even more recently, he did seem to be predicting all of this, really, even at the time of Outside. I've actually got a fantastic quote just here, which I have found.
I do have another copy of this, a jolly good book, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes. He was talking about the sort of chaos of information that was already in existence in the mid-90s, which is 10 times, 100 times more acute now. But here's the quote, Bowie saying, "There's no point in pretending, well, if we wait long enough, everything will return to what it used to be, and it'll all be saner again, and we'll understand everything, and it'll be obvious what's wrong and what's right. It's not going to be like that." And this album deals with that to an extent. This kind of surfing on chaos, that's what he called it. So that's interesting, isn't it?
Surfing on chaos.
Yeah, because we'd love to think, I think, you know, in this age of Trump and whatever, we'd love to think we can hit the reset button and go back to something that's sane. But he's right. It's not going to be that simple, is it? You know, what's this extraordinary sort of explosion of information and the different way that we handle it? And that's a large part of what's going on this album as well, I think, or what's going on in Bowie's mind about, the sort of construction of this album, is its very chaoticness is part of its structure.
Yes.
So, you know, even though it might appear to us to be a sort of slightly raggedy, almost sort of messy, strange, fraying at the seams, bit of this and a bit of that sort of album, that's the point. It did actually get very good reviews at the time, but one of the things that a lot of critics did say, or take to task about, was this idea that it's got a sort of narrative and that a pop album shouldn't have that, it should just be music. But it hasn't really got a narrative. It's got these little talky bits in between some of the tracks, but it hasn't got a beginning, a middle and an end, and they all lived happily ever after. It's absolutely obscure what's going on. The ultimate piece of inconclusiveness about it was that at the time it came out, Bowie was talking about it as possibly the first in a sequence of albums. He talked about a five-album sequence.
Outside.
Hence, that's why one outside. And then there was talk of the second one being called Two Contamination. But he talked about that being a sort of five-album cycle going up to the millennium. And of course, this became, if it was ever really the intention, it almost immediately became yet another victim of Bowie's famously short attention span, and instead he moved on to something else. And quite right, too, because that's very Bowie as well. I don't think I'd have wanted a five-album sequence.
I don't think no. You know, I mean, it wouldn't have been Bowie in the sense that it's impossible to imagine that he would have had the attention span and to really get into that. He wants to establish Nathan Adler, his protagonist here.
That's some sort of thing. And again, this is it's kind of Twin Peaksy, isn't it?
And that's something that also fed into his consciousness. I know that Twin Peaks was very, very big for Bowie. I mean, he was a huge fan of that.
Lynch and Twin Peaks. And of course, he ended up, he did appear in Twin Peaks. Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
'95, Britpop was everywhere.
Yeah.
To what extent was Bowie part of that? And do you think he even wanted to be part of that?
No, he never wanted to be a part of any sort of movement, did he? And this is another key fascinating thing about One Outside. In a way, it's just the way things turned out, because the whole Britpop explosion, I suppose it had sort of started a few years ago, again with Suede and things like that, hadn't it? And the NME and Melody Maker sort of wrapping the Union Jack around various groups' shoulders and things. But the real, you know, 1995 was the year, wasn't it? That was the year of Blur versus Oasis, which, as far as I'm concerned, was a battle that was won by Pulp. But anyway, different matter. But anyway,
menswear, surely.
Yeah, menswear. But yeah, but it was the year of Common People, wasn't it? It was the year of Country House and all those things. And there were certainly plenty of veteran British musicians who were sort of being wheeled out and had comeback albums, as it were, if that's the right phrase for them. That people like Paul Weller, like Adam Ant had a wonderful comeback album that year, actually, called Wonderful. There we go. That was a good album. Saw him live at Shepherd's Bush Empire that year. Very good. It's very Bowie and very interesting that he wasn't having any of that. He wasn't, he could have done, couldn't he? He could have gone, oh yes, I can swagger back in and have a bit of that. But he didn't. He was off in Switzerland and New York making a crazy, bendy Brian Eno album that was not, he wasn't sort of falling into step behind all these people who, to a greater or lesser extent, were people who worshipped at his altar. Mm. I mean, you know, Damon Albarn, and indeed the Gallaghers to a certain extent. I mean, you know, a lot of Oasis's greatest hits were basically rip-offs of All the Young Dudes, weren't they? I think. Pretty much, like, are we allowed to say that?
I think we can.
It is actually quite interesting, isn't it, that a lot of those people who you know spoke of their admiration for Bowie, they were talking about the very early stuff, the stuff that up until that point Bowie had pretty much drawn a veil over, and you know, eventually later on he became reconciled with his sort of pre-Space Odyssey stuff and started re-recording the song. But yeah, people like Brett Anderson were going on about how much they loved songs like Let Me Sleep Beside You, you know, really early, really obscure stuff. And I think Damon Albarn as well, you know, so that's interesting, isn't it? Maybe that was part of what helped the, you know, Bowie to sort of go back and look at his early movie. But that's a different topic. But no, I think it's interesting, isn't it, that yeah, that outside, it was a bit like what happened with Bowie during punk. You know, Bowie did sidestep punk completely and did the Berlin albums instead. You know, had they, even though he was the guy who was crashing out with Iggy Pop, the godfather of punk, he and Iggy had kind of almost nothing to do with the Sex Pistols.
Exactly.
And that's what, you know, they that bypassed completely. And this again, this is kind of what happened here, that One Outside couldn't be more different from Britpop, really.
I think its feet are very much in Brit art. And not Britpop. I mean,
right.
If you look at his friendship with Damien Hirst around that time.
Yes.
And he even collaborated with Damien Hirst, didn't he?
That's right. They did some spin paintings together.
Incredibly excited to be around them.
Yes.
And this also is quite interesting when we look at the structure of the album. So the album, like you said, is non-linear. It's not a conventional narrative. You know, there aren't straight songs as such. He had a much higher concept, a much broader concept for this. So with that in mind, we then approach the sessions.
Yes.
For what became One Outside.
Right. I mean, crucial, I think, to understanding the way this album hangs together is to understand the way it was put together, which was very much a sort of hybrid situation. The finished album is a hybrid, rather like in the way that an album like Diamond Dogs was. You know, it started off with the intention of being one thing, and then as time went on, it sort of gradually mutated into something else through various circumstances. So the thing with One Outside is that to bear in mind is that there were two main blocks of sessions, quite different and quite a long way apart. First sessions were at Mountain Studios in Montreux, where Bowie had recorded various things before, and they were in March of 1994, so a good, you know, 18 months or so before the album came out. And they went on, the main body of those first sessions went on for about 10 days. Embellishments and, you know, overdubs and this sort of thing went on for a few months after that. And the result of that was an album which may have been a double album, may even have been a triple album, which was going to be at that point called Leon. Interesting, Leon is one of the characters on One Outside. Little interesting side observation. It's obviously a name that had a bit of a resonance for Bowie for whatever reason, because if you think back to, of all things, the song Tumble and Twirl on Tonight, there's a character called Leon on that song. It's I've been to Leon's. So, yeah. There you go.
Any clues as to who Leon was?
Or? No, not really. I don't know why you know, it's obviously just a name. It's just a, you know, it's obviously one that Bowie thought, oh, that's a name, I'll use that. But anyway, so the first version of it, as it were, recorded in Montreux, was sort of, as far as we know, finished, as it were. And that was it, and it was done. And then Bowie discovered that no record company wanted to touch it with a barge pole, because it was really weird. You think One Outside is weird, the original version, the Leon version, was 10 times weirder. We get a flavour of how weird it was, of course, from some material that was leaked a few years ago onto the internet, which is all from the original Leon session. Now, don't get me wrong, some of this material is on the finished album. Tracks like I'm With Name, Wishful Beginnings, The Heart's Filthy Lesson, the first single, that was from the initial sessions, as were all the spoken segues, Small Pot of Land, The Motel. So there's quite a few bits that are on there. But when you hear that leaked material, which is fascinating to hear and really casts an interesting light on it, you realise that the original idea for the album was it was going to be much more of a sort of a stream of consciousness with a sort of looping back into references to things you've already heard and sort of and a kind of weird sort of ambient nightmare of it, more of a Brian Eno-y sort of an album, more of a David Lynch sort of album almost in a way as well. But anyway, I'm sure it was partly Bowie's own decision, but it was to do with the fact that he couldn't get a record company interested in it. He went back into the studio, this time in New York, at the Hit Factory, January, February 1995, again with Eno, but adding some new musicians at this point, and recorded, I don't think you could describe much that's on One Outside as being sort of mainstream or commercial, but the more sort of melodic, commercially-ish tracks Most of those were the ones recorded in this second set of sessions, nearly a year after the first session. So we're talking about tracks like No Control, Hello Space Boy, I Have Not Been to Oxford Town, the ones that are, as I say, slightly more melodic. Also the title track, Outside, and the remake of Strangers When We Meet, which is the closing track. These were done in the second set of sessions. And the end result of the album is this sort of patchwork of those two different sets of sessions. I don't think that means that the second sessions were any less experimental. Going back to the first set of sessions then, the ones in Montreux.
Now this is interesting because this is something that shows how serious Bowie was and how excited he was.
Mm.
As you're saying, the core band brings together people from the past, people from the present,
yes,
and people that he would be playing a big part in his future.
That's right. There were some people who he hadn't worked with before. There were some famous old names from the past. So yes, obviously Eno, first and foremost. This was their first collaboration, really, since Lodger. So
is
that
it
was
true
15
that they
years before.
Really got talking at his wedding and they were watching the couples dancing?
Yes, apparently so. I mean,
there's
obviously
a story I've read somewhere, which was that they were, both playing bits of music at the wedding and just watching the ebb and flow of dancers on the dance floor. Can you imagine at their wedding, at Bowie and Iman's wedding, and Bowie and Eno in a corner going, Brian, look at that.
Yeah. How conceptual. Can you go?
And Iman comes over and goes, what are you doing? Come on, get back on. Look, I've got loads of people you need to meet. Stop chatting with your mates.
Yeah, there's a wonderful line that Eric Idle came out with a few years ago, which has been remarked upon since, because he was a friend of Bowie's and he was a guest at the wedding as well. And he said, I went to David Bowie's wedding, and there was Brian Eno, Yoko Ono, and Bono from U2. And I thought, Eno, Ono, Bono. I mean, even Bowie's wedding was kind of conceptual. So anyway, I mean, that's quite possible, isn't it? You can imagine that that's the sort of conversation that would go on at David Bowie's wedding.
So they decided then to start.
So they decided the time had come to get back together. And, as I say, on the basis, for both of them, I think, the Buddha of Suburbia album had sort of brought them back. Not that Eno had been on that album, but Bowie had been thinking in a very Eno-ish way on that album.
Yeah.
And Eno had heard the album and really liked it. And so they, they both kind of said, shall we have a go?
Really is a very Eno-ish album, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, without any Eno on it. It's the most skeleton staff of any Bowie album. It's just Bowie with a couple of overdubs by Mike Garson, the great pianist that Bowie had in the 70s, who had also guested on a little bit on Black Tie, White Noise.
Yeah.
And, very importantly, one of the great unsung heroes of the Bowie story, a wonderful Turkish multi-instrumentalist called Erdal Kizilke, who lived in Switzerland as well, and that's how Bowie first got to know him. Now, he'd been sort of in and out of the Bowie story during the 80s. I think the very first thing they did together was that Erdal Kizilke collaborated on some of the original demos for the Let's Dance material, which were recorded in Montreux before they went back to New York and actually recorded the album. So that's the first thing. It was just some of the demos for that. But then later in the 80s...
He was on the Glass Spider
tour. He went out on tour with Bowie, he played bass on the Glass Spider tour and on the Sign of Vision tour as well. And they wrote a few things together. They did that wonderful film song, When the Wind Blows, together as well. And stuff like that. So he'd sort of been there, bubbling around in the background. He's a wonderful bass guitarist, a wonderful multi-instrumentalist. So basically, the Buddha of Suburbia album is Bowie and Erdal in the studio sort of passing each other increasingly obscure instruments. Do you think we should put the Andean nose flute on this one or whatever? And Erdal Kizilke,
he could
play
anything.
Just anything. So anyway, here he is again on the One Outside sessions, a key member of the team. So when you hear that amazing visceral bass on the Heart's Filthy Lesson, for example, that's the man we have to thank. On guitar, we have, of course, Reeves Gabrils of Tin Machine, the guitar player from Tin Machine, who Bowie had used one of his guitar parts from an abandoned Tin Machine track on Black Tie, White Noise, the track You've Been Around.
Yeah.
But that was his only contribution to Black Tie, White Noise. But now Bowie called him back in and said, right, it's not Tin Machine anymore, but I'd like you as my guitarist. And, of course, from that point on, Reeves was Bowie's sort of right-hand man for the rest of the 90s up until the Hours album, really. And that was an important moment in time. Mike Garson, who we've just mentioned, came back full-time. This is his first real return to the fold, rather
course,
than recording
yes,
a little overdub. This is Mike Garson
part of the band.
Back in the studio with Bowie, back among the things. For the first time since Young Americans. So, this is a long gap, nearly 20 years. So that was a big thing. And then, as you say, a bit of new blood, for Bowie at least. Sterling Campbell, fabulous drummer. He, again, had actually played on Black Tie, White Noise, a few bits on that.
Commended by Dennis Davis.
He was indeed.
He was a pupil of Dennis Davis.
He was, that's right. Yes. Bowie's great, very good, very good. very great drummer of the 70s, Dennis Davis, who played on, you know, Station to Station and all the Berlin albums and Scary Monsters. It was on Bowie's 1978 tour, the Low and Heroes tour. They were travelling around the world. And at some point during that, during the sort of New York stopover, Dennis Davis was actually moving house or moving flat. And he was moving into his new flat on his day off or whatever. And this little boy from the flat downstairs said, "Oh, mister, can I help you with your luggage, whatever?" And he knew that this guy was a drummer. And he wanted to... He said, "I want to be a drummer." And Dennis Davis said, "Well, I can teach you, give you some lessons." And he said, "Gee, what are you doing at the moment?" And he said, "Oh, I'm playing with David Bowie." Dennis Davis got this... I think he was like 13, 14, 15 years old. Right. No, certainly no older than that. Tickets to see David Bowie live, and the rest is history. Sterling Campbell grew up to be not only Dennis Davis's pupil, but to be Bowie's go-to drummer from this point onwards. Along with, actually, to be fair, there was Sterling Campbell and Zach Alford, who was also a brilliant drummer, who actually played on the Outside tour, because Sterling Campbell was busy with... He was with a group called Soul Asylum and various other things as well. So, Zach Alford's a fantastic drummer as well. So the two of them, actually, Zach Alford and Sterling Campbell, kind of alternated after that as the main... drummers that Bowie used for the rest of his career. Now, they were the sort of core band in the original Mantra sessions, which were, as we said, very experimental, all sorts of strange experiments going on. One of the weird things that went on was that Bowie and Eno together, before the sessions, concocted a sort of fictional universe that they wanted the sessions to take place in. And Eno wrote this bizarre tract about... a sort of fictional world where these musicians exist, and he invented names for all of the band, and they were just Bowie and Eno both shared a penchant for anagrams. They loved anagrams. So as a result, Reeves Gabrels became Elvis Gabir, which is an anagram, you know. Sterling Campbell was P. McClurt Singbell, Mike Garson was G. Noisemark, and so on. And Eno and Bowie wrote little biogs for them, of who these weird characters were in this other world, in this other place. The drummer character, the Sterling Campbell character, was supposedly... There's a line in it about something like he keeps an audio library of fatal gunshot wounds, which he uses as percussion sounds. This sort of crazy stuff, you know. This is all in, by the way, Eno's book, you know, his diary, Year of Swollen Appendices.
Yes.
If you read that book, that's all in there. This whole tract is reproduced in there. And there's loads of fascinating stuff about the Outside sessions in that book.
There's also another lovely bit where he was given flashcards to all the different characters on the first day of the sessions.
Yes.
And he gave one as, "You are the disgruntled member of a South African rock band. Play the notes that were suppressed."
Yes, that's right. Brilliant. Brilliant. That's so Eno, isn't it? It's a sort of 15 years on development on what they were doing, obviously, on Heroes and Larger.
Yeah.
It's the same sort of... And it wasn't just... I think it's important to realise that they were actually getting at something. They weren't just sort of pissing about. One of the things that Eno was very keen to ensure didn't happen was the sort of consensus that sets in. If you bring a load of musicians into a studio and say, right, it's all up for grabs, it's free and easy, let's just see where this goes. And Bowie was very keen to do that. And he had art materials around as well for people to draw with, and he would just do charcoal pictures while other people were jamming away. And it was like that. The whole idea was to have this sort of creative environment where anything goes and anything could be allowed to happen. But the danger of that, as Eno pointed out himself, was that if you get a load of musicians together and do that, then basically what can tend to happen is that they all just simmer down to what we can all agree the rules are, and they basically just start playing the blues, basically. Now, one might say, with a certain amount of justification, that is kind of what happened with Tin Machine. Reeves Gabrels was a very creative and avant-garde out-there guitarist. The Sales Brothers were absolutely sort of Delta blues, sort of right down and dirty, and so, you know, a lot of Tin Machine does end up being the weird clash of experimental and this is what we do in Texas. For the Outside sessions, you know, one of the reasons Eno was coming up with these crazy strategies and doing these things was that he was saying, he talked about this later, was that he was very keen to make sure that the conditions didn't start to creep in where everyone just started to agree on what they were doing and just ended up doing sort of some stuff from the 1950s.
Bowie was so determined to make this a democracy that, yes, the inevitable happens and everyone just starts noodling. Whereas in this case, did Bowie and Eno have the concept of the story? Was that more or less in place at the beginning, do you think? Or was that something that evolved as they went along? Did they start to tease out this sort of, you know, this loose narrative about the detective Nathan Adler and so on and so on?
I think it grew organically. I think Bowie knew from the beginning that this was the sort of album he wanted to make. You know, he knew that this wasn't going to be a Tin Machine album. He wanted to do something quite crafted, something with a sense of theatre, something with a sense of place. He went into the project sort of saying, you know, I'm thinking Diamond Dogs-y again, that kind of thing. I, you know, to one more time create a sort of fictional setting for my strange, whatever it might turn out to be, opera thing.
So he creates
this city that, or the town of, it's called Oxford Town, New Jersey, which is sort of a fictional setting, and then he starts populating it with characters. Now, I don't think he sat down and wrote out a sort of Bible before they, you know, before they started recording, but it gradually started falling into place bit by bit, because the segues, the spoken bits where he plays these different characters, were very, very improvisational. That was just Bowie sort of, you know, flying in the studio and seeing what came out. And again, in the leaked material, you know, the stuff that didn't get released that we have heard some of nowadays, there's loads of that. There's loads more Nathan Adler and loads more Ramona A. Stone, the strange sort of cyborg arts dealer, and all of those things. And that was
my favourite is Algeria Touch.
Oh, Shriek. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Algeria Touch Shriek. You see, this is the thing. People take the Mickey out of Outside. They seem to think, bizarrely, in my opinion, that Bowie hadn't noticed that it was silly. Of course, he knew it was silly. You know, people go, he's impersonating a 78-year-old man called Algeria Touch Shriek. How can I take that seriously? Yeah, I think Bowie was onto the joke as well. You know, he didn't. You know, if he wanted it not to be silly, he probably wouldn't have done that, would he? You know, and as ever with Bowie, it treads this fine line between being ridiculous and being magnificent, and it's always been like that.
But he believes it, and that's why we have to. And so it sounds preposterous and pretentious and pompous and all these things at times, but here he is in the heart of it with these characters, and it's the first time he's doing characters really since Thin White Duke. I mean this is in a different sense.
I mean, you know, there are certain songs here and there that one might point to, as you know, that you can, I'm sure you can find songs on Scary Monsters or even on Never Let Me Down where there's a sort of element of character or an element of theatre. But yes, the idea that he's that an album has been beamed down from another environment, almost another planet or something, that hasn't happened, as you say, since
that's been a long time
since something like the Thin White Duke. Absolutely interesting. I want to pick up on a word you just mentioned, which is a very interesting one, I think, which is pretentious. Because again, of course, it's pretentious. It's not really a criticism. Bowie didn't think it was a criticism. He and Eno back in the 70s, you know, they coined it. They said, we've formed the new school of pretension. They were all for it. They wanted it. You know, they didn't want to be producing some sort of knuckle-dragging rock and roll album. They absolutely didn't. They wanted something weird and precious and slightly up itself and delicate and poncy. And you know, that's absolutely the point. But through that comes this music that is, I think, incredibly powerful. The actual music on the album, which we haven't really talked about probably, but we will, is so extraordinarily, it's so extraordinarily powerful and good. And so all of this sort of apparatus, all of this stuff that it's sort of hung on, all of the stuff we've been talking about so far, is just the sort of framework about it, but it's not the actual piece of art.
And so Leon takes us outside.
Yes, so the opening track. So this is certainly one of the ones from the early sessions.
This is a
little bit of one of the great ambient washes that on the original thing would have gone on for goodness knows how long. You can just hear Bowie's voice in the background intoning snatches of dates and names and places, and so it's sort of setting the scene in a very sort of cryptic and sort of weird, let's say, let's admit it, way. But pulling us into the world of the album, you know, it's a little bit Diamond Dogs, isn't it? It's a little bit like
it's
narration
also
at the beginning of that. And it's a little, I think you probably can't avoid comparing it as well to the U2 album, Zooropa, which has that kind of bit, which again, of course, the obvious connection, in itself an interesting opening gambit, isn't it, to start with a piece of ambient wash,
yes.
Rather than start with a big bang or a big guitar or something, you know, it fades in with this sort of twinkly, strange, you know, ooh, we're not in Kansas anymore sort of thing. I think it sets the scene beautifully, and then of course it just harmonically segues very beautifully into the opening, the title track, Outside. Which, interestingly, despite the fact that it goes in harmonically very beautifully, was recorded, as I say, almost a year later in New York. It's one of the ones from the second set of sessions.
Now I really, really like this track. It's got all these, you know, this like big cloud of guitars and everything coming in, and then you hear it and there's something familiar that starts to unfurl. when I heard this, I thought, that's Look Back in Anger.
Yes.
It is, isn't it? What's going on? There's a bit
where the chords first really hit in. Certainly a sort of close relative or descendant of specifically the revamped version of Look Back in Anger that Bowie did in 88.
Yes.
With Reeves Gabrels and Erdal Kizilkay. But I know exactly the bit you mean. When the first drums kind of roll in and then you get these great big sort of power chords.
Yes.
So it's definitely harking back to that. But it's actually a song with quite a history. It's a sort of an adaptation of an adaptation. Anyway, I mean, Outside began life as a song that someone else we haven't mentioned, Kevin Armstrong. Oh, we should perhaps just throw into the pot so that we know what we're talking about, some of the other musicians who came along for the New York sessions. Kevin Armstrong, who had played, he's the sort of unsung fifth member of Tin Machine. We hear a lot about the fifth Beatle. Kevin Armstrong was the fifth Tin Machine. He also played with Bowie at Live Aid and on some of his mid-80s tracks, like Absolute Beginners, things like that. And anyway, so he was back for these New York sessions, as was Bowie's veteran guitarist Carlos Alomar. And a different drummer called Joey Barron, and a few other people. So just to put that in, because, yes, the song Outside began life as a song that Kevin Armstrong actually wrote in the early 80s, before he ever worked with Bowie. The song was called Love is Essential. He recorded it himself, and it was also covered by a band called The Passions in about 1983, I think.
I'm in love with the German film star.
Yeah, that's right. Is that them? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yes. So anyway, fast forward to 1989, and Kevin Armstrong played guitar on the first Tin Machine tour.
Yes.
At some soundcheck or other, he was playing that. And Bowie said, oh, what's that? I like that. And he said, oh, it's that song I wrote, Love is Essential, from a few years ago. And Bowie liked it enough to say, can we do something with that? Can we adapt it? And they came up with a new thing based on the same song called Now, which Tin Machine did actually play a few times live on their first tour. They never recorded they certainly didn't release a studio version of it anyway. So they did that. And then, a few years later, the same thing then got sort of workshopped on to eventually become this song Outside. So it kind of had a... But this is again, a very Bowie thing, isn't it? A lot of his tracks are sort of things that have evolved from previous ideas.
But even by his standards, that's an incredibly long...
That's quite a long gestation period, absolutely. But it does set the scene. It's funny to think that it came in the later sessions and was a sort of hybridised version of something that already existed, because it seems so much a part of this album and works so well. And of course, it establishes this whole millennial angst of the album. The repeated line of the beginning is now, not tomorrow. And then, of course, the great bellowed chorus line is the music is outside. The music, and it's not exactly subtle, is it? It is kind of saying, look, I'm not, you know, this ain't top 10, mate. Right. This music
it's
is outside.
Outside.
Have you got it yet? I love it. It's great. I mean, I actually love that track, that line so much that in my book, my foreword or introduction or whatever, the first bit of blurb in my book, I called that The Music is Outside, because it's just such a pithy summation of Bowie
Absolutely.
Right through the ages, isn't it?
Yes, it just sets the scene beautifully.
Yeah, the music is outside.
And it's very dramatic. We talk a lot about how this album is, you know, perceived as being non-commercial, but this is a great classic Bowie song.
It's a great, wonderful bit of sort of grandiloquent sort of Bowie theatre, isn't it? It's a real sort of curtain up on an album piece,
All the band are really, really powering behind him.
Yeah.
The drums, everything just... Comes together, and it sounds great.
And it's got all these some wonderful little bleepy, strange Eno noises going on as well. You know, so
it's like, great. Okay, everyone, here we are. Yeah. The gang's back together for one last drop.
Leading into, of course, the real sort of, you know, the next track was the first single. And one of the most, or probably surely the most uncompromising single that Bowie ever released. But what even on this album is one of the most out there tracks, The Heart's Filthy Lesson. Now, I'm going to put my cards right on the table here. This is one of my all-time favourite Bowie tracks. I think.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. Totally. I love
it. I thought
you were
going to tell me that this is one of your all-time least favourite.
No.
Because you don't have favourites.
We've long established that. But if I did have some sort of top 20 or top 10, this would probably be in there. Oh, God, I love it. It is so...
It's not a favourite of mine, I really have to say.
No, I mean, it's a Marmite, isn't it? I know plenty of people whose opinions I admire who think it's just an absolute... din. I mean, I think it's thrilling. I think the chord sequences in it are amazing. The middle eight is incredible. But more than anything else, just the soundscape of it, the sort of visceral chugging bass and those drums. I mean, I just find it utterly thrilling. You know, like much of the album, we've talked a lot about Brit art, we've talked a lot about the, you know, other surrounding influences. We haven't actually talked about various potential sort of musical influences. Of course, you know, Bowie had been of late listening to things like Nine Inch Nails and a lot of the sort of American sort of industrial music. And I think in something like this, you can hear a bit of that going on. The record companies asked him to go away and put some more tunes on, and he acquiesced to that, you know, did get a deal, and out it came. But nonetheless, you know, they could have put out, I don't know, No Control, yeah. which is a beautiful, beautiful song, and I love it to Hotel, bits. And I will talk about that a lot later as well. They could have put that out as the first single, but no, they put out this weird, grungy, dark, spitting thing where he's shouting to someone called Ramona, what on earth is going on? How can this possibly be a hit? Well, of course, it didn't go to number one, but it did go to number 35 in the UK, which, okay, that's really? Not any great shakes, but that's not bad.
That's
for
not
this.
Bad.
I mean,
yeah.
listen to this crazy thing. That's not bad. But I think the most important thing is that it was a statement, deliberately released something absolutely out there as the single, because that was part of the point of the whole exercise, you know. Didn't do quite as well in the US, by the way, but it did chart, which is more than some things have ever done. It went to number 92 in the United States, so, you know, not great. But at least it did. But yeah, no, it's wonderful. And what's it all about? Well, God knows. But it's got this sort
did
of montage cut
the,
up
the
lyric.
Lesson?
What
is the heart's filthy lesson?
It falls upon deaf ears. That's the trouble. It is a fantastic death abyss. I know that. It's obviously there's some kind of arcane ritual going on in it, but the lyric is very much of a cut up. This is something else we haven't talked about, is it? He's back in the realm of doing his lyrical cut ups. Again, we're talking about the days of Diamond Dogs and things, and this is absolutely one of those. That what had moved on is, whereas in 1973-74 he used a pair of scissors and pieces of paper and move them around. By this point, he's using a computer program that a friend of his did.
Yeah,
I think the verbicizer was just a little bit later. That was for earthing.
Nick, I've got my Bowie cut-up program.
Oh, absolutely, got your cut-up program. Get you. But no, same principle. But I think it's important to realise that the point of these, because people sometimes don't quite get this cut-up thing, I think, it's not that he was just trying to generate gibberish. That's absolutely not the point. It was just to free up the associations that come with mixing up words, and then he would take the bits he liked, just a juxtaposition of one word with another, and go, oh, that's good, we'll have that, and then incorporate it into a sentence. Otherwise it would just be absolute gibberish. So he's sort of using technology to help him.
There's a value there still.
He still arranges it very much in the same way that when they were doing the Berlin album, something like those instrumentals on low. It wasn't just utterly random. It wasn't just blindfold ourselves
and
hit
another key. There is a structure. There is a system. How we reach that end result, I think, is the fascinating part. And I think that's something that we talk about a lot in this album, is the process. He was talking about this in Cracked Actor back in 74, 75.
Right,
William Burroughs. But then also people like Brian Gysin, for example, were... And I think Gysin was famous for getting big stacks of newspapers and slicing these stacks up. Gysin was like a Bowie archetype of an outsider character.
Yes, he totally was. Yeah. He absolutely was. And Bowie, along with William Burroughs and obviously all the rest of them, Bowie did particularly admire Brian Gysin. He harks back to him again a little bit later on this album. There's a little talky bit in Hello Space Boy, which you actually can hear more clearly on the Pet Shop Boys remix right at the beginning, where he's saying, if I fall, moondust will cover me. Yeah. Well, those are reputed to be Brian Gysin's dying words in 1986. That's just Bowie putting in a little reference for our delectation. But it's interesting, isn't it, that one of the things, pulling this back to the heart's filthy lesson, one of the phrases that you hear in the lyrics here is sitting in the Laugh Motel. Now, if you listen to the leaked material, this thing about the Laugh Motel comes up over and over again. It's one of the sort of recurring locations in this fictional landscape of this album. It makes me think of the Beat Hotel, which is a famous thing, you know, in Paris, where, of course, Brian Gysin and Allen Ginsberg, it's where Burroughs wrote The Naked Lunch, which Bowie was a huge fan of. You know, the famous Beat Hotel. So here we have the Laugh Motel. I can't help thinking there's something there, you know, because this is a very Beat album, isn't it? It's a very Burroughs, a very Gysin thing. So yes, this is part of what's going on.
You could say that was a sort of homage snuck in there just to reference the Beat Hotel and Burroughs and Gysin and everything.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Without it having to be something that you need to go and, you know, get hung up on and sort of, oh, that's what it's all about. Because it's not really, but it's part of the massive universe of influences that are pouring into this album. It's a very sort of leaky album, isn't it? It's very ventilated.
It's very well ventilated.
The central idea of the album, such as it is that this detective is investigating a hideous murder of a young girl who has been murdered and then dismembered and her body left as a sort of work of art. Mm. And there's this extraordinary short story that is in the album booklet, which was originally published in a magazine a few months before, but that Bowie wrote. And it's written in this kind of hard-boiled detective Sam Spade sort of, Dashiell Hammett sort of way or whatever. Obviously sort of narrated by Nathan Adler. And yes, it describes this murder scene in gruesome detail, and then it ends with this sort of darkly comic punchline where he says, "It was definitely murder, but was it art?" And it's just, this is where Bowie is. It's all of it. It's about murder, it's about art. He is absolutely having a time of his life, I think. But it just walks that tightrope of almost being really tasteless, but it's not, because it's so ridiculous that it's a horror movie, and it's
totally over the top. Yeah. He's singing in a very grandiose theatrical way. There's a lot of stylization in the vocals, and from the punch of Outside to the Heart's Filthy Lesson is the album in two steps.
Yes, that's right. Once you know that's the sort of mise en scène of the whole thing, I think a song like the Heart's Filthy Lesson is a very menacing song, but it is also sort of wonderfully absurd as well. There's a wonderful bit where the rhythm track just stops and he goes, "Who's been wearing Miranda's clothes?" And then the music comes in again. And it's absurd, but it's also thrilling. I find it really thrilling. It's a great little magic moment. And then the video, oh God, I love the video as well. Directed by Sam Baer, who had made his name really with the Nirvana video, Smells Like Teen Spirit. Fabulous video of Bowie and his sort of, as it were, acolytes in a old dusty artist studio, and it's all tattoos and piercings and strange sort of scarifications, almost as though, this again is a very 1990s thing. It's a very Nine Inch Nails grungy thing. This sort of counterculture, this search for a sort of alternative spirituality outside the mainstream. This is another theme in the album and another theme in Bowie's life, as we've talked about before. And the video is beautiful. It's quite disturbing. It's quite
nasty. Very disturbing. It's very disturbing. But you touch on the Nine Inch Nails there, where their stories entwine around this time.
Yes.
And this constant search for meaning in this video, and actually in this album, Bowie seems very liberated. There's certainly a real sense of excitement. I mean, he's away from the suited and booted black tie white noise character,
right,
into somebody who is like this kind of snarling manic gnome, and he's in these very dark situations.
Absolutely.
And they're incredibly provocative as well.
And live as well on stage, very interestingly. Since whenever, certainly since Let's Dance, when he'd gone out on tour, he'd the hair colour might have changed and the costumes might have changed, but he was basically, smartly turned out in a nice suit of whatever sort, even with Tin Machine, the Sound and Vision tour. Beautiful suits, a bit sort of thin white dukey. On the Outside tour, for the first time since way back sort of Diamond Dog sort of time, he was dripping in makeup and earrings and eyeliner and strange, weird costumes. And sort of, he had these kind of designer-y t-shirts with paint splashed across them and things like that. I mean, he looked like he'd just come out of painting a mural and hadn't bothered to get changed. But anyway, when I got to see them doing it live, I mean, this song, all of it, actually, it's the best Bowie tour I ever saw, no question.
Did they do the whole album?
Not all of it, nearly all of it. Didn't do it in order, but there were a couple of tracks he never did live, but most of it was done on that tour. But yeah, songs like this, live. By then, of course, Gail Ann Dorsey, another long-term recruit from that point on, she joined for the Outside tour on bass. But hearing the Heart's Filthy Lesson bass being absolutely walloping out across, even the big arenas, it was still kind of rearranging your internal organs. It was so strong, that bass. Oh God, it was a thrilling, thrilling song to hear live. It was a real statement in so many ways. And as I mentioned earlier on, it was also used in the closing credits of Seven, which just seemed so of a piece at the time. It seemed so appropriate, I thought that was a wonderful film. I didn't know, actually, I don't think I knew at the time that the song was at the end. And, by the time I went to see it, I'd already seen the tour, the Outside tour and everything, and I sat through this film with Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt and all these horrible murders going on. Get to the end, and I just thought, wow, that was a ride. And then the Heart's Filthy Lesson kicks in. I thought, yes, of course.
Couldn't it get
of course.
Any better?
That was me and Nick Pegg just about scratching the surface of Outside. And there's much more where that came from, so please do stay tuned for the next instalment. Thank you, as ever, to Nick Pegg for being such a star man, and thank you, dear listener, for having made it to the end. And I hope you're back with me for part two, and in the meantime, let's take it outside.